The circus stuntman and test pilot today enjoy greater life assurance than did the railroad brakeman of yesterday, whose work called for precarious leaps between bucking freight cars at the command of the locomotive's whistle. Also subject to sudden death were the train couplers, whose omnipresent hazard was loss of hands and fingers in the primitive link and pin devices. Whether a worker was mutilated by a buzzsaw, crushed by a beam, interred in a mine, or fell down a shaft, it was always his own bad luck. Bad luck was a convenient explanation for employers, and until recently it was a part of a widespread fatalism about lethal accidents, which were commonly attributed to destiny or acts of God. Today, safety engineers and public health researchers don't even use the word accident, since it implies a fickle finger of fate. The term of art is unintentional injury. The first safety measures and insurance policies in the 18th and 19th centuries protected property, not people. As injuries and deaths started to increase unignorably during the Industrial Revolution, they were written off as the price of progress, according to a non-humanistic definition of progress that was not reckoned in human welfare. A railroad superintendent, justifying his refusal to put a roof over a loading platform, explained that men are cheaper than shingles. There's a dozen waiting when one drops out. The inhuman pace of industrial production has been immortalized in cultural icons such as Charlie Chaplin on the assembly line in Modern Times and Lucille Ball in the chocolate factory in I Love Lucy. Workplaces began to change in the late 19th century. As the first labor unions organized, journalists took up the cause, and government agencies started to collect data quantifying the human toll. Bettman's comment on the lethality of work on trains was based on more than just pictures. In the 1890s, the annual death rate for trainmen was an astonishing 852 per 100,000, almost 1% a year. The carnage was reduced when an 1893 law mandated the use of air brakes and automatic couplers in all freight trains, the first federal law intended to improve workplace safety. The safeguards spread to other occupations in the early decades of the 20th century, the progressive era. They were the result of agitation by reformers, labor unions, and muckraking journalists and novelists like Upton Sinclair. The most effective reform was a simple change in the law brought over from Europe, employers' liability and workmen's compensation. Previously, injured workers or their survivors had to sue for compensation, usually unsuccessfully. Now employers were required to compensate them at a fixed rate. The change appealed to management as much as to workers, since it made their costs more predictable and the workers more cooperative. Most important, it yoked the interests of management and labor. Both had a stake in making workplaces safer, as did the insurers and government agencies that underwrote the compensation. Companies set up safety committees and safety departments, hired safety engineers, and implemented many protections, sometimes out of economic or humanitarian motives, sometimes as a response to public shaming after a well-publicized disaster, often under the duress of lawsuits and government regulations. The results are plain to see in Figure 12-7. At almost 5,000 deaths in 2015, the number of workers killed on the job is still too high. But it's much better than the 20,000 deaths in 1929, when the population was less than two-fifths the size. Much of the savings is the result of the movement of the labor force from farms and factories to stores and offices. But much of it is a gift of the discovery that saving lives while producing the same number of widgets is a solvable engineering problem. Who by earthquake? Could the efforts of mortals even mitigate what lawyers call acts of God? The droughts, floods, wildfires, storms, volcanoes, avalanches, landslides, sinkholes, heat waves, cold snaps, meteor strikes, and, yes, earthquakes? That are the quintessentially uncontrollable catastrophes? The answer, shown in Figure 12-8, is yes. After the ironic 1910s, when the world was ravaged by a world war and an influenza pandemic, but relatively spared from natural disasters, The rate of death from disasters has rapidly declined from its peak. It's not that with each passing decade the world has miraculously been blessed with fewer earthquakes, volcanoes, and meteors. It's that a richer and more technologically advanced society can prevent natural hazards from becoming human catastrophes. When an earthquake strikes, fewer people are crushed by collapsing masonry or burned in conflagrations. When the rains stop, they can use water impounded in reservoirs. When the temperature soars or plummets, they stay in climate-controlled interiors. When a river floods its banks, their drinking water is safeguarded from human and industrial waste. The dams and levees that impound water for drinking and irrigation, when properly designed and built, make floods less likely in the first place. Early warning systems allow people to evacuate or take shelter before a cyclone makes landfall. Though geologists can't yet predict earthquakes, they can often predict volcanic eruptions and can prepare the people who live along the rim of fire and other fault systems to take life-saving precautions. And of course, a richer world can rescue and treat its injured and quickly rebuild. It's the poorer countries today that are most vulnerable to natural hazards. A 2010 earthquake in Haiti killed more than 200,000 people, while a stronger one in Chile a few weeks later killed just 500. Haiti also loses 10 times as many of its citizens to hurricanes as the richer Dominican Republic, the country with which it shares the island of Hispaniola. The good news is that as poorer countries get richer, they get safer, at least as long as economic development outpaces climate change. The annual death rate from natural disasters in low-income countries has come down from 0.7 per 100,000 in the 1970s to 0.2 today, which is lower than the rate for upper-middle-income countries in the 1970s. That's still higher than the rate for high-income countries today, 0.05, down from 0.09, but it shows that rich and poor countries alike can make progress in defending themselves against a vengeful deity. And what about the very archetype of an act of God? The projectile that Zeus hurled down from Olympus? The standard idiom for an unpredictable date with death? The literal bolt from the blue? Figure 12-9 shows the history. Yes, thanks to urbanization and to advances in weather prediction, safety education, medical treatment, and electrical systems, there has been a 37-fold decline since the turn of the 20th century in the chance that an American will be killed by a bolt of lightning. Humanity's conquest of everyday danger is a peculiarly unappreciated form of progress. Some readers of a draft of this chapter wondered what it was even doing in a book on progress. Though accidents kill more people than all but the worst wars, we seldom see them through a moral lens. As we say, accidents will happen. Had we ever been confronted with the dilemma of whether a million deaths and tens of millions of injuries a year was a price worth paying for the convenience of driving our own cars at enjoyable speeds, few would have argued that it was. Yet that is the monstrous choice we tacitly made, because the dilemma was never put to us in those terms. Now and again a hazard is moralized and a crusade against it is mounted, particularly if a disaster makes the news and a villain can be fingered, a greedy factory owner, a negligent public official. But soon it recedes back into the lottery of life. Just as people tend not to see accidents as atrocities, at least when they are not the victims, they don't see gains in safety as moral triumphs, if they are aware of them at all. Yet the sparing of millions of lives and the reduction of infirmity, disfigurement, and suffering on a massive scale deserve our gratitude and demand an explanation. That is true even of murder, the most moralized of acts, whose rate has plummeted for reasons that defy standard narratives. Like other forms of progress, the ascent of safety was led by some heroes, but it was also advanced by a motley of actors who pushed in the same direction inch by inch. Grassroots activists, paternalistic legislators, and an unsung cadre of inventors, engineers, policy wonks, and number crunchers. Though we sometimes chafe at the false alarms and the nanny state intrusions, we get to enjoy the blessings of technology without the threats to life and limb. And though the story of seatbelts, smoke alarms, and hotspot policing is not a customary part of the Enlightenment saga, it plays out the Enlightenment's deepest themes. Who will live and who will die are not inscribed in a book of life. They are affected by human knowledge and agency, as the world becomes more intelligible and life becomes more precious. Chapter 13. Terrorism. When I wrote in the preceding chapter that we are living in the safest time in history, I was aware of the incredulity those words would evoke. In recent years, highly publicized terrorist attacks and rampage killings have set the world on edge and fostered an illusion that we live in newly dangerous times. In 2016, a majority of Americans named terrorism as the most important issue facing the country, said they were worried that they or a family member would be a victim, and identified ISIS as a threat to the existence or survival of the United States. The fear has addled not just ordinary citizens trying to get a pollster off the phone, but public intellectuals, especially cultural pessimists, perennially hungry for signs that Western civilization is, as always, on the verge of collapse. The political philosopher John Gray, an avowed progressophobe, has described the contemporary societies of Western Europe as terrains of violent conflict in which peace and war are fatally blurred. But yes, all this is an illusion. Terrorism is a unique hazard because it combines major dread with minor harm. I will not count trends in terrorism as an example of progress, since they don't show the long-term decline we've seen for disease, hunger, poverty, war, violent crime, and accidents. But I will show that terrorism is a distraction in our assessment of progress, and, in a way, a backhanded tribute to that progress. Gray dismissed actual data on violence as amulets and sorcery. Table 13.1 shows why he needed this ideological enumeracy to prosecute his Jeremiad. It shows the number of victims of four categories of killing: terrorism, war, homicide, and accidents, together with the total of all deaths in the most recent year for which data are available, 2015 or earlier. A graph is impossible because swatches for the terrorism numbers would be smaller than a pixel. Start with the United States. What jumps out of the table is the tiny number of deaths in 2015 caused by terrorism compared with those from hazards that inspire far less anguish or none at all. In 2014, the terrorist death toll was even lower at 19. Even the estimate of 44 is generous. It comes from the Global Terrorism Database, which counts hate crimes and most rampage shootings as examples of terrorism. The toll is comparable to the number of military fatalities in Afghanistan and Iraq, 28 in 2015, 58 in 2014, which, consistent with the age-old devaluing of the lives of soldiers, received a fraction of the news coverage. The next rows down reveal that in 2015, an American was more than 350 times as likely to be killed in a police blotter homicide as in a terrorist attack, 800 times as likely to be killed in a car crash, and 3,000 times as likely to die in an accident of any kind. Among the categories of accident that typically kill more than 44 people in a given year are lightning, contact with hot tap water, contact with hornets, wasps, and bees, bitten or struck by mammals other than dogs, drowning in submersion while in or falling into bathtub, and ignition or melting of clothing and apparel other than nightwear. In Western Europe, the relative danger of terrorism was higher than in the United States. In part, this is because 2015 was an annus horribilis for terrorism in that region, with attacks in the Brussels airport, several Paris nightclubs, and a public celebration in Nice. In 2014, just 5 people were killed. But the relatively higher terrorism risk is also a sign of how much safer Europe is in every other way. Western Europeans are less murderous than Americans, with about a quarter their homicide rate, and also less car crazy, so fewer die on the road. Even with these factors tipping the scale toward terrorism, a Western European, in 2015, was more than 20 times as likely to die in one of their relatively rare homicides as in a terrorist attack, more than 100 times as likely to die in a car crash, and more than 700 times as likely to be crushed, poisoned, burned, asphyxiated, or otherwise killed in an accident. The third column shows that for all the recent anguish about terrorism in the West, we have it easy compared with other parts of the world. Though the United States and Western Europe contain about a tenth of the world's population, in 2015 they suffered 0.5% of the terrorist deaths. That's not because terrorism is a major cause of death elsewhere. It's because terrorism, as it is now defined, is largely a phenomenon of war, and wars no longer take place in the United States or Western Europe. In the years since the attacks of September 11, 2001, violence that used to be called insurgency or guerrilla warfare is now often classified as terrorism. The Global Terrorism Database, incredibly, does not classify any deaths in Vietnam in the last 5 years of the war there as terrorism. A majority of the world's terrorist deaths take place in zones of civil war, including 8,831 in Iraq, 6,208 in Afghanistan, 5,288 in Nigeria, 3,916 in Syria, 1,606 in Pakistan, and 689 in Libya. And many of these are double counted as war deaths because terrorism during a civil war is simply a war crime, a deliberate attack on civilians committed by a group other than the government. Excluding these six civil war zones, the terrorism death count for 2015 was 11,884. Yet even with the double counting of terrorism and war during the 21st century's worst year for war deaths, a global citizen was 11 times as likely to have died in a homicide as in a terrorist attack, more than 30 times as likely to have died in a car crash, and more than 125 times as likely to have died in an accident of any kind. Has terrorism, whatever its toll, increased over time? The historical trends are elusive. Because terrorism is an elastic category, the trend lines look different depending on whether a data set includes civil war crimes, multiple murders, which include robberies or mafia hits in which several victims are shot, or suicidal rampages in which the killer ranted about some political grievance beforehand. The Global Terrorism Database, for example, includes the 1999 Columbine school massacre, but not the 2012 Sandy Hook school massacre. Also, mass killings are media-driven spectacles in which coverage inspires copycats, so they can yo-yo up and down as one event inspires another until the novelty wears off for a while. In the United States, the number of active shooter incidents, public rampage killings with guns, has wobbled with an upward trend since 2000. Though the number of mass murders, four or more deaths in an incident, shows no systematic change. If anything, it shows a slight decline from 1976 to 2011. The per capita death rate from terrorism incidents is shown in Figure 13-1, together with the messy trends for Western Europe and the world. The death rate for American terrorism for the year 2001, which includes the 3,000 deaths from the 9/11 attacks, dominates the graph. Elsewhere, we see a bump for the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995, 165 deaths, and barely perceptible wrinkles in other years. Excluding 9/11 and Oklahoma, about twice as many Americans have been killed since 1990 by right-wing extremists as by Islamist terrorist groups. The line for Western Europe shows that the rise in 2015 came after a decade of relative quiescence and is not even the worst that Western Europe has seen. The rate of killing was higher in the 1970s and 1980s, when Marxist and secessionist groups, including the Irish Republican Army and the Basque ETA movement, carried out regular bombings and shootings. The line for the world as a whole, excluding recent deaths in major war zones, which we examined in the chapter on war, contains a spiky plateau for the 1980s and 1990s, a fall after the end of the Cold War, and a recent rise to a level that still falls below that of the earlier decades. So the historical trends, like the current numbers, belie the fear that we are living in newly dangerous times, particularly in the West. Though terrorism poses a minuscule danger compared with other risks, it creates outsized panic and hysteria, because that is what it is designed to do. Modern terrorism is a byproduct of the vast reach of the media. A group or an individual seeks a slice of the world's attention by the one guaranteed means of attracting it, killing innocent people, especially in circumstances in which readers of the news can imagine themselves. News media gobble the bait and give the atrocity saturation coverage. The availability heuristic kicks in, and people become stricken with a fear that is unrelated to the level of danger. It's not just the salience of a horrific event that stokes the terror. Our emotions are far more engaged when the cause of a tragedy is malevolent intent rather than accidental misfortune. I confess that, as a frequent visitor to London, I was far more upset when I read the headline, "Russell Square Terror Knife Attack Leaves Woman Dead," than when I read, "Renowned Art Collector Dies After Being Hit by Bus in Oxford Street Tragedy." Something is uniquely unsettling about the thought of a human being who wants to kill you, and for a good evolutionary reason. Accidental causes of death don't try to do you in, and they don't care how you react, whereas human malefactors deploy their intelligence to outsmart you, and vice versa. Given that terrorists are not mindless hazards but human agents with goals, could it be rational to worry about them despite the small amount of damage they do? After all, we are justly outraged by despots who execute dissidents, even though the number of their victims may be as small as those of terrorism. The difference is that despotic violence has strategic effects that are disproportionate to the body count. It eliminates the most potent threats to the regime, and it deters the rest of the population from replacing them. Terrorist violence, almost by definition, strikes victims at random. The objective significance of the threat, then, beyond the immediate damage, depends on what the scattershot killing is designed to accomplish. With many terrorists, the goal is little more than publicity itself. The legal scholar Adam Lankford has analyzed the motives of the overlapping categories of suicide terrorists, rampage shooters, and hate crime killers, including both the self-radicalized lone wolves and the bomb fodder recruited by terrorist masterminds. The killers tend to be loners and losers, many with untreated mental illnesses, who are consumed with resentment and fantasize about revenge and recognition. Some fuse their bitterness with Islamist ideology, others with a nebulous cause such as starting a race war or a revolution against the federal government taxes and anti-gun laws. Killing a lot of people offered them the chance to be a somebody, even if only in the anticipation, and going out in a blaze of glory meant that they didn't have to deal with the irksome aftermath of being a mass murderer. The promise of paradise, and an ideology that rationalizes how the massacre serves a greater good, makes the posthumous fame all the more inviting. Other terrorists belong to militant groups that seek to call attention to their cause, to extort a government to change its policies, to provoke it into an extreme response that might recruit new sympathizers or create a zone of chaos for them to exploit, or to undermine the government by spreading the impression that it cannot protect its own citizens. Before we conclude that they pose a threat to the existence or survival of the United States, we should bear in mind how weak the tactic actually is. The historian Yuval Harari notes that terrorism is the opposite of military action, which tries to damage the enemy's ability to retaliate and prevail. When Japan attacked Pearl Harbor in 1941, it left the United States without a fleet to send to Southeast Asia in response. It would have been mad for Japan to have opted for terrorism, say, by torpedoing a passenger ship to provoke the United States into responding with an intact navy. From their position of weakness, Harari notes, What terrorists seek to accomplish is not damage, but theater. The image that most people retain from 9/11 is not al-Qaeda's attack on the Pentagon, which actually destroyed part of the enemy's military headquarters and killed commanders and analysts, but its attack on the totemic World Trade Center, which killed brokers, accountants, and other civilians. Though terrorists hope for the best, their small-scale violence almost never gets them what they want. Separate surveys by the political scientists Max Abrams, Audrey Cronin, and Virginia Page Fortna of hundreds of terrorist movements active since the 1960s show that they all were extinguished or faded away without attaining their strategic goals. Indeed, the rise of terrorism in public awareness is not a sign of how dangerous the world has become, but the opposite. The political scientist Robert Jervis observes that the placement of terrorism at the top of the list of threats in part stems from a security environment that is remarkably benign. It is not only interstate war that has become rare, so is the use of political violence in the domestic arena. Harari points out that in the Middle Ages, every sector of society retained a private militia. Aristocrats, guilds, towns, even churches and monasteries, and they secured their interests by force. If in 1150 a few Muslim extremists had murdered a handful of civilians in Jerusalem, demanding that the Crusaders leave the Holy Land, the reaction would have been ridicule rather than terror. If you wanted to be taken seriously, you should have at least gained control of a fortified castle or two. As modern states have successfully claimed a monopoly on force, driving down the rate of killing within their borders, they opened a niche for terrorism. The state has stressed so many times that it will not tolerate political violence within its borders, that it has no alternative but to see any act of terrorism as intolerable. The citizens, for their part, have become used to zero political violence, so the theater of terror incites in them visceral fears of anarchy, making them feel as if the social order is about to collapse. After centuries of bloody struggles, we have crawled out of the black hole of violence, but we feel that the black hole is still there, patiently waiting to swallow us again. A few gruesome atrocities, and we imagine that we are falling back in. As states try to carry out the impossible mandate of protecting their citizens from all political violence everywhere and all the time, they are tempted to respond with theater of their own. The most damaging effect of terrorism is countries' overreaction to it, the case in point being the American-led invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq following 9/11. Instead, countries could deal with terrorism by deploying their greatest advantage, knowledge and analysis, not least knowledge of the numbers. The uppermost goal should be to make sure the numbers stay small by securing weapons of mass destruction. Chapter 19. Ideologies that justify violence against innocents, such as militant religions, nationalism, and Marxism, can be countered with better systems of value and belief. Chapter 23. The media can examine their essential role in the show business of terrorism by calibrating their coverage to the objective dangers and giving more thought to the perverse incentives they have set up. Lankford, together with the sociologist Eric Madfus, has recommended a policy for rampage shootings of don't name them, don't show them, but report everything else, based on a policy for juvenile shooters already in effect in Canada and on other strategies of calculated media self-restraint. Governments can step up their intelligence and clandestine actions against networks of terrorism and their financial tributaries. And people could be encouraged to keep calm and carry on, as the British wartime poster famously urged during a time of much greater peril. Over the long run, terrorist movements sputter out as their small-scale violence fails to achieve their strategic goals, even as it causes local misery and fear. It happened to the anarchist movements at the turn of the 20th century, after many bombings and assassinations. It happened to the Marxist and secessionist groups in the second half of the 20th century, and it will almost certainly happen to ISIS in the 21st. We may never drive the already low numbers of terrorist casualties to zero, but we can remember that terror about terrorism is a sign not of how dangerous our society has become, but of how safe. Chapter 14. Democracy. Since the first governments appeared around 5,000 years ago, humanity has tried to steer a course between the violence of anarchy and the violence of tyranny. In the absence of a government or powerful neighbors, tribal peoples tend to fall into cycles of raiding and feuding, with death rates exceeding those of modern societies, even including their most violent eras. Early governments pacified the people they ruled, reducing internecine violence, but imposed a reign of terror that included slavery, harems, human sacrifice, summary executions, and the torture and mutilation of dissidents and deviants. The Bible has no shortage of examples. Despotism has persisted through history not just because being a despot is nice work if you can get it, but because from the people's standpoint, the alternative was often worse. Matthew White, who calls himself a necrometrician, has estimated the death tolls of the 100 bloodiest episodes in 2,500 years of human history. After looking for patterns in the list, he reported this one as his first. Chaos is deadlier than tyranny. More of these multicides result from the breakdown of authority rather than the exercise of authority. In comparison to a handful of dictators, such as Idi Amin and Saddam Hussein, who exercised their absolute power to kill hundreds of thousands, I found more and deadlier upheavals like the Time of Troubles in 17th century Russia, the Chinese Civil War, 1926 to 1937, 1945 to 1949, and the Mexican Revolution, 1910 to 1920. Where no one exercised enough control to stop the death of millions. One can think of democracy as a form of government that threads the needle, exerting just enough force to prevent people from preying on each other without preying on the people itself. A good democratic government allows people to pursue their lives in safety, protected from the violence of anarchy, and in freedom, protected from the violence of tyranny. For that reason alone, democracy is a major contributor to human flourishing. But it's not the only reason. Democracies also have higher rates of economic growth, fewer wars and genocides, healthier and better educated citizens, and virtually no famines. If the world has become more democratic over time, that is progress. In fact, the world has become more democratic, though not in a steadily rising tide. The political scientist Samuel Huntington organized the history of democratization into three waves. The first swelled in the 19th century, when that great Enlightenment experiment, American constitutional democracy with its checks on government power, seemed to be working. The experiment, with local variations, was emulated by a number of countries, mainly in Western Europe, cresting at 29 in 1922. The first wave was pushed back by the rise of fascism, and by 1942 had ebbed to just 12 countries. With the defeat of fascism in World War II, a second wave gathered force as colonies gained independence from their European overlords, pushing the number of recognized democracies up to 36 by 1962. Still, European democracies were sandwiched between Soviet-dominated dictatorships to the east and fascist dictatorships in Portugal and Spain to the southwest. And the second wave was soon pushed back by military juntas in Greece and Latin America, authoritarian regimes in Asia, and communist takeovers in Africa, the Middle East, and Southeast Asia. By the mid-1970s, the prospects for democracy looked bleak. The West German Chancellor Willy Brandt lamented that Western Europe has only 20 or 30 more years of democracy left in it. After that, it will slide, engineless and rudderless, under the surrounding sea of dictatorship. The American senator and social scientist Daniel Patrick Moynihan agreed, writing that liberal democracy on the American model increasingly tends to the condition of monarchy in the 19th century, a holdover form of government, one which persists in isolated or peculiar places here and there, and may even serve well enough for special circumstances, but which has simply no relevance to the future. It is where the world was, not where it is going. Before the ink was dry on these lamentations, democratization's third wave, more like a tsunami, erupted. Military and fascist governments fell in southern Europe, Greece in 1974, Spain in 1975, Portugal in 1976. Latin America, including Argentina in 1983, Brazil in 1985, and Chile in 1990, and Asia, including Taiwan and the Philippines around 1986, South Korea around 1987, and Indonesia in 1998. The Berlin Wall was torn down in 1989, freeing the nations of Eastern Europe to establish democratic governments, and communism imploded in the Soviet Union in 1991, clearing space for Russia and most of the other republics to make the transition. Some African countries threw off their strongmen, and the last European colonies to gain independence, mostly in the Caribbean and Oceania, opted for democracy as their first form of government. In 1989, the political scientist Francis Fukuyama published a famous essay in which he proposed that liberal democracy represented the end of history, not because nothing would ever happen again, but because the world was coming to a consensus over the humanly best form of governance and no longer had to fight over it. Fukuyama coined a runaway meme. In the decades since his essay appeared, books and articles have announced the end of nature, science, faith, poverty, reason, money, men, lawyers, illness, the free market, and sex. But Fukuyama also became a punching bag as editorialists, commenting on the latest bit of bad news, gleefully announced the return of history and the rise of alternatives to democracy, such as theocracy in the Muslim world and authoritarian capitalism in China. Democracies themselves appeared to be backsliding into authoritarianism with populist victories in Poland and Hungary, and power grabs by Recep Erdogan in Turkey and Vladimir Putin in Russia, the return of the Sultan and the Tsar. Historical pessimists, with their customary schadenfreude, announced that the third wave of democratization had given way to an undertow, recession, erosion, rollback, or meltdown. Democratization, they said, was a conceit of Westerners projecting their tastes onto the rest of the world, whereas authoritarianism seemed to suit most of humanity just fine. Could recent history really imply that people are happy to be brutalized by their governments? The very idea is doubtful for two reasons. Most obviously, in a country that is not democratic, how could you tell? The pent-up demand for democracy might be enormous, but no one dares express it lest they be jailed or shot. The other is the headline fallacy. Crackdowns make the news more often than liberalizations, and the availability bias could make us forget about all the boring countries that become democratic bit by bit. As always, the only way to know which way the world is going is to quantify. This raises the question of what counts as a democracy, a word that has developed such an aura of goodness as to have become almost meaningless. A good rule of thumb is that any country that has the word democratic in its official name, like the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, a.k.a. North Korea, or the German Democratic Republic, a.k.a. East Germany, isn't one. Nor is it helpful to ask the citizens of undemocratic states what they think the word means. Almost half think it means the army takes over when the government is incompetent, or religious leaders ultimately interpret the laws. Ratings by experts have a related problem when their checklists embrace a hodgepodge of good things, such as freedom from socioeconomic inequalities and freedom from war. Yet another complication is that countries vary continuously in the different components of democracy, such as freedom of speech, the openness of the political process, and the constraints on its leaders' power. So any tally that dichotomizes nations into democracies and autocracies will fluctuate from year to year, depending on arbitrary choices about where to place the countries that hover near the boundary, a problem exacerbated when the raters' standards rise over time, a phenomenon we will return to. The Polity Project deals with these obstacles by using a fixed set of criteria to assign a score between minus 10 and 10 to every country in every year, indicating how autocratic or democratic it is, focusing on citizens' ability to express political preferences, constraints on the power of the executive, and a guarantee of civil liberties. The sum for the world since 1800, spanning the three waves of democratization, is shown in Figure 14-1 in the accompanying PDF. The graph shows that the third wave of democratization is far from over, let alone ebbing, even if it has not continued to surge at the rate of the years surrounding the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989. At that time, the world had 52 democracies, defined by the Polity Project as countries with a score of 6 or higher on their scale, up from 31 in 1971. After swelling in the 1990s, this third wave spilled into the 21st century in a rainbow of color revolutions, including Croatia 2000, Serbia 2000, Georgia 2003, Ukraine 2004, and Kyrgyzstan 2005, bringing the total at the start of the Obama presidency in 2009 to 87. Belying the image of a rollback or meltdown under his watch, the number continued to grow. As of 2015, the most recent year in the data set, the total stood at 103. The Nobel Peace Prize was awarded that year to a coalition of organizations in Tunisia that solidified a transition to democracy, a success story from the Arab Spring of 2011. It also saw transitions to democracy in Myanmar and Burkina Faso, and positive movements in 5 other countries, including Nigeria and Sri Lanka. The world's 103 democracies in 2015 embraced 56% of the world's population. And if we add the 17 countries that were more democratic than autocratic, we get a total of 2/3 of the world's population living in free or relatively free societies, compared with less than 2/5 in 1950, a 1/5 in 1900, 7% in 1850, and 1% in 1816. Of the people living in the 60 non-democratic countries today, 20 full autocracies, 40 more autocratic than democratic, 4/5 reside in a single country, China. Though history has not ended, Fukuyama had a point. Democracy has proved to be more attractive than its eulogizers acknowledge. After the first wave of democratization broke, there were theories explaining how democracy could never take root in Catholic, non-Western, Asian, Muslim, poor, or ethnically diverse countries, each refuted in turn. It is true that stable, top-shelf democracy is likelier to be found in countries that are richer and more highly educated, but governments that are more democratic than not are a motley collection. They are entrenched in most of Latin America, in floridly multi-ethnic India, in Muslim Malaysia, Indonesia, Niger, and Kosovo, in 14 countries in sub-Saharan Africa, including Namibia, Senegal, and Benin, and in poor countries elsewhere, such as Nepal, Timor-Leste, and most of the Caribbean. Even the autocracies of Russia and China, which show few signs of liberalizing, are incomparably less repressive than the regimes of Stalin, Brezhnev, and Mao. Johan Norberg summarizes life in China: "The Chinese people today can move almost however they like, buy a home, choose an education, pick a job, start a business, belong to a church, as long as they are Buddhists, Taoists, Muslims, Catholics, or Protestants, dress as they like, marry whom they like, be openly gay without ending up in a labor camp, travel abroad freely, and even criticize aspects of the party's policy, though not its right to rule unopposed. Even not free is not what it used to be." Why has the tide of democratization repeatedly exceeded expectations? The various backslidings, reversals, and black holes for democracy have led to theories which posit onerous prerequisites and an agonizing ordeal of democratization. This serves as a convenient pretext for dictators to insist that their countries are not ready for it, like the revolutionary leader in Woody Allen's Bananas, who, upon taking power, announces, "These people are peasants. They are too ignorant to vote." The awe is reinforced by a civics class idealization of democracy, in which an informed populace deliberates about the common good and carefully selects leaders who carry out their preference. By that standard, The number of democracies in the world is zero in the past, zero in the present, and almost certainly zero in the future. Political scientists are repeatedly astonished by the shallowness and incoherence of people's political beliefs, and by the tenuous connection of their preferences to their votes and to the behavior of their representatives. Most voters are ignorant not just of current policy options, but of basic facts, such as what the major branches of government are, who the United States fought in World War II, and which countries have used nuclear weapons. Their opinions flip depending on how a question is worded. They say that the government spends too much on welfare, but too little on assistance to the poor, and that it should use military force, but not go to war. When they do formulate a preference, they commonly vote for a candidate with the opposite one. But it hardly matters, because once in office, politicians vote the positions of their party, regardless of the opinions of their constituents. Nor does voting even provide much of a feedback signal about a government's performance. Voters punish incumbents for recent events over which they have dubious control, such as macroeconomic swings and terrorist strikes, or no control at all, such as droughts, floods, even shark attacks. Many political scientists have concluded that most people correctly recognize that their votes are astronomically unlikely to affect the outcome of an election, and so they prioritize work, family, and leisure over educating themselves about politics and calibrating their votes. They use the franchise as a form of self-expression. They vote for candidates who they think are like them and stand for their kind of people. So despite the widespread belief that elections are the quintessence of democracy, they are only one of the mechanisms by which a government is held responsible to those it governs, and not always a constructive one. When an election is a contest between aspiring despots, rival factions fear the worst if the other side wins and try to intimidate each other from the ballot box. Also, autocrats can learn to use elections to their advantage. The latest fashion in dictatorship has been called the competitive, electoral, kleptocratic, statist, or patronal authoritarian regime. Putin's Russia is the prototype. The incumbents use the formidable resources of the state to harass the opposition, set up fake opposition parties, use state-controlled media to spread congenial narratives, manipulate electoral rules, tilt voter registration, and jigger the elections themselves. Patronal authoritarians, for all that, are not invulnerable. The color revolutions sent several of them packing. If neither voters nor elected leaders can be counted on to uphold the ideals of democracy, why should this form of government work so not badly? The worst form of government except all the others that have been tried, as Churchill famously put it. In his 1945 book, The Open Society and Its Enemies, the philosopher Karl Popper argued that democracy should be understood not as the answer to the question, who should rule, namely the people, but as a solution to the problem of how to dismiss bad leadership without bloodshed. The political scientist John Mueller broadens the idea from a binary judgment day to continuous day-to-day feedback. Democracy, he suggests, is essentially based on giving people the freedom to complain. It comes about when the people effectively agree not to use violence to replace the leadership, and the leadership leaves them free to try to dislodge it by any other means. He explains how this can work. If citizens have the right to complain, to petition, to organize, to protest, to demonstrate, to strike, to threaten to emigrate or secede, to shout, to publish, to export their funds, to express a lack of confidence, and to wheedle in back corridors, government will tend to respond to the sounds of the shouters and the importunings of the wheedlers. That is, it will necessarily become responsive, pay attention, whether there are elections or not. Women's suffrage is an example. By definition, they could not vote to grant themselves the vote, but they got it by other means. The contrast between the messy reality of democracy and the civics class ideal leads to perennial disillusionment. John Kenneth Galbraith once advised that if you ever want a lucrative book contract, just propose to write The Crisis of American Democracy. Reviewing the history, Mueller concludes that Inequality, disagreement, apathy, and ignorance seem to be normal, not abnormal, in a democracy, and to a considerable degree the beauty of the form is that it works despite these qualities, or in some important respects, because of them. In this minimalist conception, democracy is not a particularly abstruse or demanding form of government. Its main prerequisite is that a government be competent enough to protect people from anarchic violence so they don't fall prey to or even welcome the first strong man who promises he can do the job. Chaos is deadlier than tyranny. That's one reason why democracy has trouble getting a toehold in extremely poor countries with weak governments, such as in sub-Saharan Africa, and in countries whose government has been decapitated, such as Afghanistan and Iraq, following the American-led invasions. As the political scientists Stephen Levitsky and Lucan Wei point out, state failure brings violence and instability. It almost never brings democratization. Ideas matter, too. For democracy to take root, influential people, particularly people with guns, have to think that it is better than alternatives such as theocracy, the divine right of kings, colonial paternalism, the dictatorship of the proletariat, in practice its revolutionary vanguard, or authoritarian rule by a charismatic leader who directly embodies the will of the people. This helps explain other patterns in the annals of democratization, such as why democracy is less likely to take root in countries with less education, in countries that are remote from Western influence, such as in Central Asia, and in countries whose regimes were born of violent, ideologically driven revolutions, such as China, Cuba, Iran, North Korea, and Vietnam. Conversely, as people recognize that democracies are relatively nice places to live, the idea of democracy can become contagious, and the number can increase over time. The freedom to complain rests on an assurance that the government won't punish or silence the complainer. The front line in democratization, then, is constraining the government from abusing its monopoly on force to brutalize its uppity citizens. A series of international agreements, beginning with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights of 1948, drew red lines around thuggish governmental tactics, particularly torture, extrajudicial killings, the imprisonment of dissidents, and the ugly transitive verb coined during the Argentinian military regime of 1974 to 1984, to disappear someone. These red lines are not the same as electoral democracy, since a majority of voters may be indifferent to government brutality as long as it isn't directed at them. In practice, democratic countries do show greater respect for human rights. But the world also has some benevolent autocracies like Singapore and some repressive democracies like Pakistan. This leads to a key question about whether the waves of democratization are really a form of progress. Has the rise in democracy brought a rise in human rights? Or are dictators just using elections and other democratic trappings to cover their abuses with a smiley face? The U.S. State Department, Amnesty International, and other organizations have monitored violations of human rights over the decades. If one were to look at their numbers since the 1970s, it would appear that governments are as repressive as ever, despite the spread of democracy, human rights norms, international criminal courts, and the watchdog organizations themselves. This has led to pronouncements, delivered with alarm by rights activists and with glee by cultural pessimists, that we have reached the end times of human rights, the twilight of human rights law, and, of course, the post-human rights world. But progress has a way of covering its tracks. As our moral standards rise over the years, we become alert to harms that would have gone unnoticed in the past. Moreover, activist organizations feel they must always cry crisis to keep the heat up, though the strategy can backfire, implying that decades of activism have been a waste of time. The political scientist Catherine Sickink calls this the information paradox, as human rights watchdogs admirably look harder for abuse, look in more places for abuse, and classify more acts as abuse. They find more of it. But if we don't compensate for their keener powers of detection, we can be misled into thinking that there is more abuse to detect. The political scientist Christopher Ferris has cut this knot with a mathematical model that compensates for more dogged reporting over time and estimates the actual amount of human rights abuse in the world. Figure 14-2 shows his scores for four countries from 1949 to 2014, and for the world as a whole. The graph displays numbers spat out by a mathematical model, so we should not take the exact values too seriously, but they do indicate differences in trends. The top line is for a country that represents a gold standard for human rights. As with most measures of human flourishing, it is Scandinavian, in this case Norway, and it started high and has grown higher. We see diverging lines for the two Koreas. North, which started low and sank even lower, and South, which rose from a right-wing autocracy during the Cold War, into positive territory today. In China, human rights hit bottom during the Cultural Revolution, shot up after the death of Mao, and crested during the 1980s democracy movement before the government cracked down after the Tiananmen Square protests, though they are still well above the Maoist-era lowlands. But the most significant curve is the one for the world as a whole. For all its setbacks, the arc of human rights bends upward. How does the curtailment of government power unfold in real time? An unusually clear window into the machinery of human progress is the fate of the ultimate exercise of violence by the state, deliberately killing its citizens. Capital punishment was once ubiquitous among countries, and it was applied to hundreds of misdemeanors in gruesome public spectacles of torture and humiliation. The crucifixion of Jesus, together with two common thieves, is as good a reminder as any. After the Enlightenment, European countries stopped executing people for any but the most heinous crimes. By the middle of the 19th century, Britain had reduced the number of capital offenses from 222 to 4. And the countries looked for methods of execution such as drop hanging that were as humane as such a gruesome practice could pretend to be. After World War II, when the Universal Declaration of Human Rights inaugurated a second humanitarian revolution, capital punishment was abolished altogether in country after country, and in Europe today it lingers only in Belarus. The abolition of capital punishment has gone global. Figure 14-3. And today the death penalty is on death row. In the last three decades, two or three countries have abolished it every year, and less than a fifth of the world's nations continue to execute people. While 90 countries retain capital punishment in their law books, most have not put anyone to death in at least a decade. The UN Special Rapporteur on Executions, Christopher Hines, points out that if the current rate of abolition continues, not that he's prophesying it will, capital punishment will vanish from the face of the earth by 2026. The top five countries that still execute people in significant numbers form an unlikely club: China and Iran, more than 1,000 apiece annually, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, and the United States. As in other areas of human flourishing, such as crime, war, health, longevity, accidents, and education, the United States is a laggard among wealthy democracies. This American exceptionalism illuminates the tortuous path by which moral progress proceeds from philosophical arguments to facts on the ground. It also showcases the tension between the two conceptions of democracy we have been examining: a form of government whose power to inflict violence on its citizens is sharply circumscribed, and a form of government that carries out the will of the majority of its people. The reason the United States is a death penalty outlier is that it is, in one sense, too democratic. In his History of the Abolition of Capital Punishment in Europe, the legal scholar Andrew Hamel points out that in most times and places, the death penalty strikes people as perfectly just. If you take a life, you deserve to lose your own. It was only with the Enlightenment that forceful arguments against the death penalty began to appear. One argument was that the state's mandate to exercise violence may not breach the sacred zone of human life. Another was that the deterrent effect of capital punishment can be achieved with surer and less brutal penalties. The ideas trickled down from a thin stratum of philosophers and intellectuals to the educated upper classes, particularly liberal professionals like doctors, lawyers, writers, and journalists. Abolition was soon folded into a portfolio of other progressive causes, including mandatory education, universal